It's June 21st, 2025, in Astoria, Queens. Next Tuesday, we have a primary election. I'm standing on a stranger's porch, looking at plastic bins filled with campaign literature. Soon, I'll bring them to my car and take them to a staging location nearby, where hundreds of volunteers will show up to grab materials and fan out across the neighborhood, knocking thousands of doors. I had never done anything like this before in my life. My name is Tim Donovan. I've lived in Astoria, Queens for 15 years now and counting. I spent a decade as a bartender in the neighborhood too, at a bougie cocktail and oyster bar called Mars on 34th Ave and 35th Street.
It's funny, the first time someone called me comrade in 2019 was like a little strange, and I was like, okay. Sir.
Zoran reached out to me. He told me he was going to run for office and he needed a website.
The first bread pickup we did in this truck, we filled this truck top to bottom and we did it out of my friend Cody's kitchen, in which you literally could not move.
With a margin that narrow, your mind goes to 1,000 decisions that you made that could have maybe, you know, when it's 55 votes.
So I turned to my mother and I was like, I have to go right now. I said, Amazon just pulled out of the deal and I have to go. I have to leave right this second, mommy.
Election day, I woke up at 4:30 a.m. because polls open at 6.
This is a story about a neighborhood's transformation and what I learned when I joined in. Welcome to the People's Republic of Astoria. This is Chapter 1, 10 Perfect Strangers. It's June 26th, 2018.
The numbers that you're seeing right now.
I cannot believe these numbers right now, but I do know that every single person here has worked their butt off to change the future of the Bronx and Queens. That's what I know. And that every single person is responsible for this.
I'd never volunteered ever before, and I jumped in feet first. I think I did something like 3 shifts a week for like 6 months.
Shauna Morlock started canvassing in January of 2018. She'd go on to knock tens of thousands of doors.
I saw that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was running for Congress in my district.
So then let's go back even further. So you've never done it before. You decide you want to get involved. What did that look like?
Yeah, you know, I'm a geriatric millennial, so I'm, you know, right on the cusp of Gen X. And so I was very much into Facebook at the time.
Back then, Shauna was the mother of a 4-year-old daughter. And with Trump in office, she was pissed.
When Trump won in 2016, it just really was like eating a hole in my psyche. It was just nonstop stress, you know, the constant doom scrolling, just everything seeming like it was on fire around me.
She knew she had to do something. She just didn't know what.
Actually, so the very first like local political activity that I did was the Women's March protest in 2017. Which was like cathartic and it felt good to yell, you know, but after that happened, I was like, okay, well, now what?
Now what? It's a question I was asking myself too, at least for a while. In 2016, after the presidential election, I joined the Democratic Socialists of America, as well as the Queens County Young Democrats. And for a few months, I went to all the meetings. I showed up, I listened, I tried to figure out where I fit in. I wanted to learn how the systems themselves operated, but it just felt like social gatherings, networking events, mixers. I always felt like I should be handing out business cards or holding a lukewarm cup of coffee. What was just more talking supposed to accomplish? I didn't last 6 months. So I watched my neighborhood transform. I even cheered from the sideline. But I never got involved.
And so when I saw that AOC was running, and this was like pretty early, I'd say January of 2018, something like that, I saw that it was happening. I went to a local canvas in Astoria Park.
Shauna was new to organizing, but even the people running it back then were inexperienced.
It's funny, at that time, it was really like a scrappy, you know, project. I was just like one of maybe 10 people at this canvas, which is a lot. But for a congressional campaign, you need to like really hit as many doors as you can. So I went out on my own from the very beginning. Yeah, I was just feet first.
The campaign staff that day didn't think they could win.
I do remember one of them saying, we're not going to win this campaign. Like that Joe Crowley is just like too powerful. You know, we're just really like trying to build out infrastructure and like, it's wonderful that you're here and thank you. But, you know, maybe trying to set expectations low.
Because back then, Astoria was different.
Western Queens had always been politically moderate to conservative.
Donald Trump comes from Queens. Andrew Cuomo comes from Queens. Archie Bunker comes from Queens.
Archie Bunker territory.
I didn't have no million people out there marching and protesting to get me my job.
No, his uncle got it for
him. Astoria still got some of that old New York feel. Butchers and fishmongers still exist, though fewer and fewer as time goes on. There's a street called Steinway, filled with Egyptian grocers and hookah lounges. The sweet smell of shisha overwhelms your senses as you walk down it. And Astoria is an old ethnic enclave, too. Mostly Greeks and Italians. A place stuck in the past. Or at least, it used to be.
A hard left 28-year-old named Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
She comes up and picked me to do the, do a trial run and like, I'll be the person on the doors and you be the canvasser. And I was so awkward and weird and nervous. But yeah, I remember thinking back to what that guy was telling me, that like, oh, we can't win. And I was like, I don't know. I think she might actually be able to, you know, there was that thing with her. And I was like, I think we can do it.
So Shauna started knocking on doors.
I probably had the same TERFs. Like, so a TERF is an assignment for you, like for, you know, a number of doors to go knock on. And I probably did that same TERF 5 times. I don't know.
While Shauna was learning how to canvass, a young activist named Michael Thomas Carter was trying to make a decision. Should he hold them, fold them, or go all in?
I'm always looking for that line, that play that maybe you win with it, maybe you lose with it. It's almost like when you're playing poker, right? And like both the world where you win and the world where you lose exist simultaneously in that moment.
Michael was a young man in his 20s living in Brooklyn, and the Bernie campaign had just lost. He was asking himself the question, now what?
I was initially living in New York, being a tutor, kind of making ends meet, auditioning as an actor also. And I started to volunteer. I worked the last 5 days of the primary. That my first day was the Washington Square Park rally with 20,000 people, which was wild.
But through the Bernie campaign, he'd joined a nascent movement. And that would lead him to new opportunities.
And so when I heard that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was running, I got an email in my inbox saying, I'm running for Congress against Joe Crowley.
Michael replied to the email. He would become the second paid employee of the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez primary campaign.
And I said, hey, if there's anybody who we as a movement could take out and make a huge impact, it would be Joe Crowley.
In 2008, when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was just a 19-year-old sophomore at Boston College, her father died suddenly of a rare form of lung cancer. For the next 4 years, her family would find themselves lost in the Byzantine processes of the Westchester County surrogate court system. In interviews she gave 10 years later, during her congressional campaign, she described a system of court-appointed lawyers who were, quote, shaving off fees. To stay afloat, her mom worked 2 jobs, while she bartended. In a Newsweek piece from the time, her mother Blanca described real estate people coming around, snooping outside the house, taking photos. You can almost picture their mouths watering. AOC declined to be interviewed for this podcast, but she's spoken publicly about these experiences.
My first interview with Alexandria was after an Abolish ICE protest in Foley Square. We kind of like went to the protest and then we had a talk, like kind of in the square, in the street, about the race, how to move forward, plans to win, all of that. And then I was brought on board. My first day of work was in Alexandria's apartment in Parkchester. She had a sign on her wall that said Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez for Congress. And it was like me, VG, and her boyfriend Riley, and her.
As Michael was getting involved in AOC's campaign, I was just working at Mo's when I heard that a young bartender was running against a local congressman. I asked myself, how the hell would she take down Joe Crowley?
Joe Crowley, at the time, was the head of the Queens Democratic Party machine, somebody who was widely touted as being the next Speaker of the House for the Democratic Party. So a very powerful person in a lot of different ways.
This story was part of the Democratic machine. It was very Greek. It was very pro-police.
Ross Birkin is a journalist, novelist, contributor to the New York Times Magazine, and former state Senate candidate. He's been writing about New York and Queens for years.
The old machine bosses had machines. They had clubhouses and people they would turn out.
There are three lawyers in the Queens Democratic Party of that era, and they're still around, actually, Sweeney, Reich, and Bowles, who had created a system whereby they would automatically represent people who were in foreclosure or inheritance disputes and thereby make millions of dollars from the loss of homes by working class people in Queens.
In Westchester, that same system had been bleeding fees out of the small nest egg left to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's family when her father passed away suddenly in 2008. For AOC, this whole story was personal. And in Queens, where she was running, Joe Crowley's allies had it down to a science.
And the reason they were able to control that is because of the control they have over the judge selection process. Really, there's been a lot of writing about this, a lot of coverage, a lot of journalism that you can look up.
Crowley, through his position in Congress, through the fact that he was a very good inside operator, the fact that he had a lot of influence in the city council, he was very close to Christine Quinn, who was the powerful council speaker. His predecessor, Tom Manton, had helped pick council speakers as well.
Crowley had stopped organizing his district, but in his defense, who wouldn't have? It had been 14 years since he'd even had a primary challenge. He'd won 10 elections in a row by more than double digits. His predecessor had handed him his seat.
I mean, you had real patronage operations. The Queens Democratic Party had a patronage operation through the court system, somewhat, and through City Hall as well, and through the City Council. But it was not nearly as extensive as kind of the old line patronage operations were. The machine was not really a machine anymore. There was very little political organizing the Democratic Party in Queens did by the 2010s, but he wielded a lot of soft power. He didn't live in the district. He lived in Virginia. He lived in a very nice house in Virginia, which was known. I mean, AOC very wisely made an issue in the race, and in her great ad, still to this day, maybe the best political ad ever created, she made that point very plain about how Joe Crowley did not breathe the air and drink the water we do. And that was very compelling.
Foreclosure, doesn't live here, doesn't send his kids to our schools, doesn't drink our water or breathe our air, cannot possibly represent us.
I mean, that election, I mean, it was about progressive, you know, it was about a progressive candidate versus a centrist and the defeat of the center by the left. But really, it was also about someone who was organizing the district against someone who wasn't.
Let them know that this is just the beginning.
By the time primary day rolled around, AOC's army of volunteers had knocked over 100,000 doors in her district spanning the Bronx and Northwest Queens. Crowley's campaign stuck to the old method, tried and true. Blanket the airwaves with TV ads. Hit radio. Get glossy mailers in every mailbox. He'd raised over $3 million, most of it from corporate PACs and financial firms. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez only raised $800,000, mostly from small donors, people like me. The machine still had the money. It still had the endorsements. What it didn't have?
And so, yeah, just hit doors in my area. It works. We really crush it in Queens.
When there's a real ideology, you get a level of commitment that money can't buy.
So how do 10 people in a park beat a 10-term incumbent congressman with $3 million in the bank, who has all the union endorsements, all the political endorsements, who controls the whole local political machine? The answer turns out to be simpler than anyone could have expected. You just show up. Also, it really helps if your opponent doesn't.
Veteran New York City Democratic Congressman Joe Crowley has gone down to primary defeat tonight after he sent a stand-in to represent him at a recent debate. The New York Times editorial board wrote, "If you want to be speaker, don't take voters for granted."
The establishment had gotten lazy. As winter turned to spring in 2018, the volunteer lists were growing. Election night, June 2018.
She's right here. I can't let you go.
She realized she won on live television on New York One.
How are you feeling? Can you put it into words?
Nope. I do know that every single person here has worked their butt off to change the future of the Bronx and Queens. That's what I know.
I'm not the best educated, well-read socialist, not doing the book clubs. I'm more of just like a person who arrived to this place because I deeply care about my neighbors and wanting to take care of like everyone, no matter who they are, where they live. There's lots of people who are going up and down here, and I think that the world can be better and that we have a position and like we have a job to do to try to make it better. You can't just wait for other people to do it for you. And it feels good. Once you win that first campaign, it's like, we can do this over and over and over. It's not just one shot or two shots. And it's like building up a culture of service.
In 2024, Donald Trump was reelected president. And a whole new generation of activists were sitting at bars, doom scrolling on their phones. One of them was a 24-year-old named Magdalena. She'd recently gotten involved with the Zohran Mamdani primary campaign. He was a young state legislator running a long-shot bid for mayor, and currently polling at just 2%.
Presidential election night, watch party was at catch. Sorry, I was not like checking any polling, whatever. Didn't know what was happening. I was like kind of out of sight, out of mind. And everyone was already like, it's not looking great. And I was like, okay. I was like, I could feel the vibes are down. Things are not looking good. I was like, I need to go back to Astoria. I was like, I think I need to be closer to home.
Back in Astoria, Magdalena was surrounded by friends.
Zohran actually came in to the watch party that night. We knew what was happening. We knew Trump was getting elected. It was actually like very nice to see Zohran and like get to say hi.
For Magdalena, that question, now what, it already had its answer.
This is what we need to focus on. We are going to elect this man. This man is going to become our next mayor.
Magdalena would be at Zohran's first campaign canvas. She got to work immediately.
I set out being like, I want to canvas once a week. Towards like that final month, it ended up being more like 3-4 days a week, honestly. Oh, I'm like creating real change, but also like I love doing this with these people.
I'm still to this day friends with a lot of people that I met through that race, like and even people that aren't even necessarily like doing electoral organizing any longer.
Largely, a lot of the people I hang out with and like a lot of my social circle is people who do this kind of work.
The politics, the policies, the doom scrolling, the rage. That might have been the impetus for this work at first, but for Shauna and Magdalena and thousands like them, that's not what kept them coming back.
you know, we're very intentionally trying to make DSA a home for people, not just for politics, you know, but just as a communal space for people who, you know, deeply care about society and like taking care of your neighbors and trying to, I guess, rebuild those places that we've lost.
The post-canvas social is so crucial to building a canvas. That's where the bonds form. That's where people like want to come back and canvas with you again the next week.
It's also a weird thing as an adult to like meet people and to make literally like hundreds of genuine, you know, camaraderie and affection for like hundreds of people that you've met throughout the years.
It also like helps people from just like honestly staying on their couch. It's like, because every volunteer thing, you're fighting the couch.
You know, usually people substitute this with their work. You know, you make your work friends and then you go to another job and like you probably don't keep in touch with those people anymore. But I'm seeing the same people year after year after year after year with our electoral campaign.
I don't remember if I was working at Moe's the night that AOC won, but it wouldn't have made a difference. Places like that exist as a refuge from politics. It's a place to sip cocktails and forget about real life. Shauna Morlock had knocked on doors 3 nights a week for 6 months with a 4-year-old child at home. Michael Thomas Carter had gone all in on a 10% chance. 10 people in a park had transformed into hundreds and then thousands. And a 29-year-old bartender had just taken on a 10-term congressman and won. In a few short months, they'd done something real. Something that actually worked. And me? Joined a few organizations, quit them the moment it seemed pointless. I tried to make a difference, but decided it was a waste of time. So I deleted Twitter, stopped reading the news. It was comforting to not watch the world fall apart. And I told myself they didn't really need me, not here in the People's Republic. I could take comfort in the fact that I was happy. I really was. I really am. My wife has a great job. I've got great family, great friends. I get to spend my days in the greatest city in the world. But what I didn't have was an answer to a simple question that Shauna, Magdalena, and Michael had all figured out. Now what? That's because for me, I'd stopped asking completely. Next time on the People's Republic of Astoria, episode 2, 20 years apart.
She gave me two names. One seemed like he couldn't do it or didn't want to do it. And the other person was this 26-year-old organizer they'd hired, and his name was Zoran Mamdani.
I mean, billionaires don't lose. Trillion-dollar corporations don't lose. Real estate developers in New York City don't lose. And when they lost, they were f***ing pissed.
The People's Republic of Astoria is written, narrated, and produced by Tim Donovan. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. For show notes, more information, and episode transcripts, visit our website at peoplesrepublicpod.com. Music by Perosian. Special thanks to my wife Alice for all of her great ideas, her endless support. Without her, none of this is possible. Thanks to Daisy Luong and Sarah Noe. Thanks to Shauna Morlock, Michael Thomas Carter, Magdalena Miranda, Ross Barkin, and all the other guests. See you next time in the People's Republic.
You gotta be ready.